Is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and it is Wednesday, the 10th of July. It's 11 p.m., and thank you for joining us for the 73rd episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that. And if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. Okay, so the name of that song was called Gotta Be On My Way. And as is the case occasionally from time to time, it's one of mine, so it's a shameless self-promotion yet again. It's a song I wrote about an individual who used to work at a clinic that I worked at, who thought she was the cat's meow, and to quote a friend of mine describing a narcissist, she thought she was hot shit and she wasn't even warm diarrhea. So,
well,
to say that she had it, isn't that great? I told him I was going to steal it. And so because she had this exaggerated sense of herself, she ran off just about everybody that worked there, including me. So I figured I'd immortalize her in a song and called Gotta Be On My Way.
All right. Thank you very much for that. And as always,
sure.
Thank you for all the original stuff. Shameless plugs are welcome here since it's your show too. Alrighty, so as Dr. Mathis alludes to, tonight's episode is entitled The Dunning-Kruger Effect Part 2, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, well, since I gave a shout-out last time to Eric Clapton's famous Gibson SG, The Fool, I thought I'd give a shout-out to a competing brand played by one of his best mates, George Harrison. So the history goes, as most people know, that the Beatles, and Harrison in particular, was a big Gretsch freak, and so Harrison played a lot of Gretsch guitars in the early days, primarily because his hero was Chet Atkins, who was sponsored by Gretsch, and so he had several models. There were Chet Atkins models that Gretsch made, which they still make to this day. And so at one point, George got a used duo jet, and then eventually got several Country Gentlemen's, which is the guitar that Chet Atkins used, and one of whom had a signature on it, and a Gretsch Tennessean, which Chet Atkins also played. So they were pretty much Fenderless at that point, if you will, and John was playing a lot of Rickenbackers and various guitars, and Paul was predominantly playing Hofners. And occasionally he would, you know, venture into other stuff, eventually got into Rickenbackers and various other guitars. But what was really troubling the sales manager at Fender at the time, whose name was Don Randall, was that he wanted, you know, the biggest band in the land, so to speak, to be seen playing Fenders because they would boost sales, as that always happens. So he made an initial pitch to them, which didn't really go that well. And he said, okay, well, I screwed that one up. Let's try this again. So he ends up going to, they were on tour in America, and he went to the hotel the first time and didn't fly really well. So then he ends up going, I think in 68, actually met John and Paul at Apple headquarters in London and was trying to get them, trying a second time to get them to play some Fenders. So he sits down with the boys and has a great conversation with Paul and a pretty good conversation with John. The story goes until Yoko walked in, and then Don kind of like, who is that? And I can't say as I blame him. Oops, did I say that? That was my unmedicated voice. Anyway, So he comes in and he convinces the guys to start using some Fender stuff. So he leaves a jazz bass for McCartney and a couple of Fender Rhodes pianos, which you see Billy Preston playing on a lot of the videos. And he left a Fender a six, which is a six-ring bass he used to make back in the day, which they don't make anymore. On rare occasions, they'll reissue it. And George actually plays that on Let It Be. He's playing the bass part on Let It Be on a Fender six string. So he convinces George to let them make him a specialty guitar, Telecaster. So he gets together with one of his head custom luthiers at the time, Rosmeisel, that's it. Couldn't remember his last name, and he was Ross something, one of those Budentite guys. Anyway, Rosmeisel. And he got together with Phil Kabuki at Fender, who was one of their main movers and shakers. And Roger actually was the guy that came up with the Rickenbacker guitar originally. He had defected, oh, my style, Scarlett, to Fender and in 62, I think. So he gets together with Phil Kabuki, and they decide they're going to make a custom Rosewood guitar for George Harrison. And they thought, well, while we're at it, we're going to make some prototypes. So we're going to make this great solid rosewood body Fender Telecaster, and we're going to make a solid rosewood Stratocaster for Jimi Hendrix. So they worked together and ended up getting the rosewood out and took it, and George was ecstatic with it. They finished it, in late 68, and took it over to the Beatles' Abbey Road Studios and gave it to George. You know, they were just finishing up the White Album, I think. And then it was very, very closely selected. They had a specialty neck that they shaved. So it was this really, really cool guitar, and it was a prototype, and it was never in major, major manufacturing publication. And they ended up making a couple others, which disappeared. Jimi Hendrix, unfortunately, died before they could get him his, because they finished it around 69, I think. And he died, I think, in April of, of September 1970, and I think they finished the Telecaster first, and they didn't finish the Strat till 70, like mid-70, and by the time they got the Strat to Jimmy, he was already passed. So they made two Strats and two Tellys, and nobody knows what happened to the other Strat or the other Telly, and the one of them ended up, in 2012, 2013, I can't remember, at a Chicago music store, and was sold, and because the Strat never got to Jimmy. And the other Rosewood Telecaster evidently got sold to Elvis Presley, or sent to Elvis Presley, which I don't think he ever played, and eventually went to an auction, and to my knowledge, it's still unsold as of late 2018. So somewhere there's a prototype Fender Telecaster solid Rosewood out there. After the Beatles kind of did their thing, you can see, those folks who are interested in seeing it, George plays the Rosewood Telecaster on the famous Roof Show, which is the last concert the Beatles ever did together in January of 1970. And George is playing the Rosewood Telecaster on Don't Let Me Down and Get Back. So if you ever want to see what that looks like, it's a pretty amazing guitar. So later, he gives the guitar away to Delaney and Bramlett, who was playing with Bonnie and Delaney and Friends, obviously. He's the Delaney of Bonnie and Delaney, the group that Eric Clapton joined after Blind Faith. And Delaney kept the instrument until he sold it in the early 2000s, a couple of years after George's death. And it is reported to have sold at auction for over $400,000. That's, of course, and the person who bought it was George Harrison's wife, Olivia Harrison, which I thought was really cool. So as far as I know, she still got it in her collection. I suspect his son Donnie's playing it from time to time. So that's kind of the way it goes. And they put the Telecaster into production. They finally got the Telecaster into production, I think, in late 69 or early 70, but it was so heavy. And of course, the rosewood is a protected wood, and so they had to really charge an arm and leg for it, and it basically didn't sell very well, and they quit making production of it. They didn't make very, very many. They later in the 80s made a Japanese version, made in Japan version, and then they introduced more recently a custom shop model of the Harrison Rosewood Telecaster. And what they did was, if you wanted one, you called up the factory and you paid a deposit on it, and they made it for you on site, so to speak, by order. And they had a limit of 90. They didn't even come anywhere close to that. I don't know how many said they sold, but they did not sell very many of those units. And they have just recently reissued them in a slightly less customized, if you will, form. It's more of a team built instead of an individual, actual master build kind of luthier thing. So they're making a special edition that they're just releasing very soon now, the Rosewood Telecasters. People who saw them or got to play them were just oohed and awed by them at the tone. But I can tell you, I own one of the custom shop ones that they made back in the earlier in 2000. I think it was 2015 or 2016. I own one of those. And let me tell you, that thing's heavier than – it's like a Les Paul. So all the Tele guys are like, oh, my God, this is too heavy. And I'm like, screw you, honey. It sounds fabulous, okay? So just sit down when you play it and stop whining. But anyway, it's a great guitar. And if you see Harrison playing it on – if you see the movie Let It Be, he's playing it on some of the shots in Let It Be, too. So it's just it's a really, really cool guitar. Any music geeks and guitar geeks should definitely check that out. And if you've got a lot of money in your closet to spend, or one of your bonds comes to maturity and you're a guitarist, go out there and get yourself one. Do yourself a favor. They are fabulous. So there you have it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening up until around midnight. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Tonight's show is called The Dunning-Kruger Effect, Part 2 of 2. In the field of psychology, the Dunning-Kruger Effect is a relatively newly recognized cognitive bias in which people mistakenly assess their cognitive ability as greater than it is. It is related to the cognitive bias of illusory superiority and comes from the inability of people to recognize their lack of ability. Without the self-awareness of metacognition, people cannot objectively evaluate their competence or incompetence. Dunning-Kruger itself is not in the DSM-5 as a formal disorder, or the ICD for that matter, but we will discuss how it does relate to some behavior and cognition issues that are. On our last show, part one, we discussed the definition of the Dunning-Kruger effect and related terminology, and studies and other psychology history leading to the codification of this disorder. On tonight's show, we will discuss Dunning-Kruger viewed professionally and how to know if you may have it, and what can be done if you do have it or are close to someone who does. And before we get started, I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you'd like to bring up before we get started.
Nope, I'm good.
All righty. So before we dive in technically, I wanted to bring up something I ran across a couple days ago. Before we begin our full discussion, I wanted to share some critiques of the methods of the original study, simply to be clearer on the various potential biases or flaws within it for discussion and perspective. And the post that I'm using was written by Tal Yarkoni, PhD, who is the director of the Psychoinformatics Lab and a research assistant professor, Department of Psychology, University of Texas at Austin. And this was on his blog, talyarkoni.org, and this entry was titled, What the Dunning-Kruger Effect Is and Isn't. It was written in 2010, July of 2010. And these are the notes that I cropped out for you guys. Quote, the critical point to note is that there's a clear positive correlation between actual performance, the gray line, he's referring to a graph in the blog, and perceived performance, black line. The people in the top, Q-U-A-R-T-I-L-E, is that quartile? I don't know if you know, Dr. Mathis, I am not familiar with that word, but it's like the top quarter of the graph that's involved. For actual performance, think they perform better than the people in the second quartile, who in turn think they perform better than the people in the third quartile, and so on. So the bias is definitely not that incompetent people think they're better than competent people. Rather, it's that incompetent people think they're much better than they actually are. But they typically still don't think they're quite as good as people who, you know, are actually good. That said, it's clear that there's a very large discrepancy between the way incompetent people actually perform and the way they perceive their own performance level, whereas the discrepancy is much smaller for highly competent individuals. So the big question is why? Kruger and Dunning's explanation, as I mentioned above, is that incompetent people lack the skills they'll need in order to know they're incompetent. For example, if you're not very good at learning languages, it might be hard for you to tell that you're not very good because the very skills that you'd need in order to distinguish someone who's good from someone who's not are the ones you lack. If you can't hear the distinction between two different phonemes, how would you ever know who has native-like pronunciation ability and who doesn't? If you don't understand very many words in another language, how can you evaluate the size of your own vocabulary in relation to other people's? Over the past few years, a fairly sizable literature criticizing or extending Kruger and Dunning's work has developed. I'll mention just three plausible and mutually compatible alternative accounts people have proposed. First, regression towards the mean. Perhaps the most common criticism of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that it simply reflects regression to the mean. That is, it's a statistical artifact. Regression to the mean refers to the fact that anytime you select a group of individuals based on some criterion and then measure the standing of those individuals on some other dimension, performance levels will tend to shift or regress towards the mean level. It's a notoriously underappreciated problem and probably explains many, many phenomena that people have tried to interpret substantively. In the context of Dunning-Kruger effect, the argument is that incompetent people simply regress toward the mean when you ask them to evaluate their own performance. Since perceived performance is influenced not only by actual performance, but also by many other factors, e.g. one's personality, metacognitive ability, measurement error, etc., it follows that on average, people with extreme levels of actual performance won't be quite as extreme in terms of their perception of their performance. That's the first one. Second, regression to the mean plus better than average. Having said that, it's clear that regression to the mean can't explain everything about the Dunning-Kruger effect. One problem is that it doesn't explain why the effect is greater at the low end than the high end. That is, incompetent people tend to overestimate their performance to a much greater extent than competent people understand their performance. This asymmetry can't be explained solely by regression to the mean. It can, however, be explained by a combination of RTM, regression to the mean, and a, quote, better than average or self-enhancement heuristic, which says that, in general, most people have a tendency to view themselves excessively positively. This two-pronged explanation was proposed by K-R-U-E-G-E-R, Kruger and Muller in a 2002 study. Note that Kruger and Kruger of the effect are two different people, who argue that poor performers suffer from a double whammy. Not only do their perceptions of their own performance regress toward the mean, but those perceptions are also further inflated by the self-enhancement bias. Source Kruger J and Muller R.A. 2002. The paper was unskilled, unaware, or both. The better than average heuristic and statistical regression predict errors in estimates of own performance from the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Okay. Theory number three, the instrumental role of task difficulty. Consistent with the notion that the Dunning-Kruger effect is at least partially a statistical artifact, some studies have shown that the asymmetry reported by Kruger and Dunning, i.e., the smaller discrepancy for high performers and for low performers, actually goes away and even reverses when the ability tests given to participants are very difficult. For instance, Burson and colleagues in 2006, writing in JPSP, showed that when University of Chicago undergraduates were asked moderately difficult trivia questions about their university, the subjects who performed the best were just as poorly calibrated as the people who performed worse, in the sense that their estimates of how well they did relative to other people were wildly inaccurate. What should we conclude from these and other studies? I think the jury's still out to some extent, but at minimum, I think it's clear that much of the Dunning-Kruger effect reflects either statistical artifact, regression to the mean, or more general cognitive biases, the tendency to self-enhance or to use one's subjective experience as a guide to one's standing in relation to others. This doesn't mean that the metacognitive explanation preferred by Dunning-Kruger and colleagues can't hold in some situations. It very well may be that in some cases and to some extent, people's lack of skill is really what prevents them from accurately determining their standing in relation to others. But I think our default position should be to prefer the alternative explanations I've discussed above because they're A, simpler, B, more general, in other words, they explain lots of other phenomena, and C, necessary. We should also try to be aware of another very powerful cognitive bias whenever we use the Dunning-Kruger effect to explain the people or situations around us, namely confirmation bias. If you believe that incompetent people don't know enough to know they're incompetent, it's not hard to find anecdotal evidence for that. After all, we all know people who are both arrogant and not very good at what they do. But if you stop to look for it, it's probably also not hard to find disconfirming evidence. End quote. And there, I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you care to add anything.
No, I'm pretty good. Thanks.
Okay. So having put up that explanation, pardon me, I lost my place for a quick second. Sorry. So let's get to the first part of what we're going to discuss tonight, which was section 3 of last week, since we didn't get to it. And that is Dunning-Kruger viewed professionally and how to know if you may have it. And when I say professionally, I'm using the term a bit loosely because, as I have said before and I'm about to explain again, this is not technically a pathology, but it is something that happens, and it relates to some pathologies that are listed. So, unlike most of the topics we cover on our show, neither Dunning-Kruger effect nor illusory superiority are listed in the DSM-5 or the ICD-11, and not just by a technicality of hierarchy, as is, for example, Asperger's syndrome. That's not listed, but it got folded into something else. That's not what's happened here. There are times when behaviors or traits are not mental illnesses, pathologies, or disorders. They can, of course, still be a huge problem and even cause some level of harm, but they are not psychological disorders as such, and so would be addressed in different manners than something that was a disorder. And now, on this line, I have a couple questions for you, Dr. Mathis, and we'll go down these one at a time. So first, I would like to ask, what is the neurotypical mental process, your average person, by which we learn how to discern the reality about our abilities and competencies? How do we learn to accurately gauge our own abilities?
Well, normally, you know, what's considered quote-unquote normal is what's normal for your particular cohort, which means your age group and your gender group. And you also have to take into consideration things like your nationality, the status, socioeconomic status, education level, ethnic racial stuff, because all of those figure into what's quote-unquote normal behavior. So, you know, as I pointed out before about this term ethics, which I think is really an overused term, folks have heard me talk about that. You know, what was considered okay and ethical and not, you know, a faux pas 50 years ago in regards to certain gender orientations and certain racial ethnic groups is no longer considered kosher. So what would have been neurotypical 50 years ago is not neurotypical anymore. Now it's considered to be, you know, very, very bad taste, if nothing else. And so I think that when you're looking at something like estimating your abilities, you really have to look at your abilities in relationship to your peer group, whomever that might be. So, you know, one of the things I joke with a lot of my patients about, of course, is, as you know, and any of our listeners know who've seen pictures of me, I'm not your quote-unquote neurotypical doctor. In the sense that I have very, very long hair, and I play, you know, hard rock and heavy metal music. I also play blues and jazz and, you know, whatever, acoustic, but whatever. But the point being, people walk into my office and they're expecting a guy with short hair and a suit and a tie and, you know, clean shaven and very demure, and that isn't what they get. So now you have to go, okay, the clean shaven part they get, but none of the rest of it, right? So... I get one out of seven, right? So, yes. So what happens is, you know, they start making judgment calls about it. And when I catch them doing that, and some of them will vocalize it, and they're very polite about it most of the time, not sometimes not so much, but sometimes they're very, you know, polite about it. And I just laugh when people do that, and I go, well, because you can see it. You go in the waiting room and you see them, and they give you this look with the hair, and you can just feel it, right? And they come back in the office, and then they see all the diplomas and certifications on the wall, and then they look at, then they look around the room and they see the guitar and the Marshall amplifier in the room. And it's this cognitive disconnect. It's really cute when it happens. I always get a big charge out of that. But the point being, they're comparing me against what they're used to, what my peer group is supposed to be. So now it begs the question, is this a disorder or not? Well, certainly I have disorders. There's no two ways about that one. But just the fact that I'm an eccentric guy and that I, you know, wear my hair in a manner that's not quote normal doesn't necessarily make it a pathology. So part of this really goes down to what is a mental disorder? What is a psychological disorder? And it's something that limits you in some significant way in one or more areas, usually more than one area, or it's a behavior that you exhibit with your significant others and or in public that also has a negative impact on other people, whether it's academically, socially, occupationally, whatever. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is certainly annoying with folks, and there are certainly a lot of folks out there who have mistaken beliefs about their abilities, and I have to tell you, most of the ones that I find that think they're smart are not, and the dummies are the ones that have the biggest degree of the Dunning-Kruger effect, in my personal opinion, and I personally believe it's because they don't have the ability to look at it. Plus, I think it's a combination of a narcissistic defense, and I'm not suggesting they're narcissists. Please don't confuse those two. But I think it's a narcissistic defense for them not to admit to themselves how stupid they are. Frankly, let's just be blunt about it. They don't want to accept it. And let's face it, a lot of our people don't. You know, a lot of folks here in this country don't want to accept reality. You know, we like the fantasy because we think that's going to be easier, but it's not. Be that as it may, if you're looking at your own self in terms of your behavior, your abilities, it becomes a disorder if you overestimate your stuff and you apply for jobs that you're clearly not competent for, but you're not able for whatever reason to see it, so you keep getting rejected, and now you're all depressed and stressed out because you're running out of money and you don't have a job. So now your Dunning-Kruger behavior, if you will, may have resulted in you now developing a case of anxiety and or depression based on your financial status and or the flack you're getting from your colleagues or peer groups, or if you're, you know, still living at home with mom and dad and they're supporting you, they're like, hello, go out and get a job at Burger King. Come on, you're not going to be CEO of the company. You got a high school diploma. Get with the program, right, or whatever. So it often can lead to disorders if it's exhibited to a significant degree in enough areas that it's going to bite you in the assets, basically. It also will give you a lot of flack in social interpersonal situations when you come out and talk about what a great, you know, musician you are or chef or, you know, whatever. And, you know, you show out and you're not that great and people kind of look at you like, dude, did you do too many mushrooms before you showed up for the jam tonight? You know, you can't play cocaine. Really? The song, not the drug. And, you know, and that's a very easy song to play. It's a great tune, but it's a very easy song to play. You know, Knocking on Heaven's Door is a great tune, but it's a four-chord song. You can't play that. Go back home. You're done. And so you get these people who think they're great, you know, songwriters and musicians or whatever. And, you know, the real people who are really good are scratching their heads going, what the hell? So it causes you, at the very least, embarrassment and social isolation in socioeconomic, the socio-interpersonal things. In the work world, it often costs you your job if you're bad enough and you try to overshoot it. Or if you show up and you tell your boss you can do A, behaviors A, B, and C, and then you fall short, pretty soon your boss is going to get pissed off. You're going to get fired. So this is not a great thing to do. So what I tell people to do is really do get out of your body in a sense. Look at it like you're looking at, examine your behavior and your competencies. Do a checklist, an honest checklist like you are a third-party person. If you watch somebody else that look like you doing these same behaviors or had the same database of information that you have about this topic or same skill set level or whatever, would you consider that person an expert? Would you consider that person super competent, right? So if you've got enough wherewithal to remove yourself from yourself, because as you know, certain people have said, philosophers have said over the years, self-love blinds us to our own stuff sometimes. So if you can get out of your body, this way, if you have the ability, right, so if you're somebody who's exhibiting the Dunning-Kruger effect, but you have the ability to do it, but your self-love blinds you from it, or your, you know, pride or whatever, if you can dissociate in a sense and look at it like a third-party person and do an evaluation, you know, what would you say to that person? Go back and get some more training? Try for a less, you know, complex job? What? And then do the behavior you would advise your friend to do. That's going to get you a lot further out than continuing to delude yourself. The other thing I tell people to do is talk to folks who are experts in the field and get them to give you their honest opinion. And when they give it to you, thank them. Don't make excuses. Don't play the yes, but game. Oh, yeah, but, you know, I normally can do that, but I just got out of the wrong side. Shut up, dude. You're done. The guy told you you suck. Now go back and figure out what you can do to not suck, okay? This is real simple. And so go to somebody that's an expert and get them to point out stuff that, you know, it's an expert in the field and get them to give you an honest evaluation. And if you don't measure up, ask them to give you some pointers on how you can measure up and then get out there and work your assets off, because then you won't have to worry about the Dunning-Kruger effect, because if you remediate your stuff and you have the ability to do it, you'll be doing it. It'll be a fait accompli.
I'm just thinking that there may be people struggling with this, and that last part I think requires a certain element of self-awareness that some of them might lack. So I hope people can take that advice to heart and not take it as an attack. It's help. And
no,
I hope it's
received
that way.
No, I'm not slamming anybody. I'm really not.
Oh,
yeah,
I realize that. But
the other thing
I'm
tell
worried
people is
that they may not realize.
Well, and what I'd say is the other thing is talk to somebody that you trust, whose opinion you trust, that you feel has your best interest in, and ask them what they think. And ask them to be very honest with you. And then listen to them and do what they said, what they say. And if they say, yeah, you've just gotten some really bad breaks, you're really good at this, I wouldn't give up. Okay, great. Now you have confirmation you don't suck. That's just as good. I mean, any information you get is good information. So if you think you're suffering from this in a certain arena, you know, and it could be arena specific, it could be in general, you could think you're the greatest looking gal on the planet, and that you're best Susie Homemaker, and that you're the best, you know, sexual partner on the planet, and that you're the best CEO in the world, that you leap tall, you know, Empire State Buildings with a single bound. if you could talk to people in different arenas, and, you know, find out what you're good at, what you're not good at, remediate what you're not good at, or hire somebody to do it for you, and don't worry about it. This is not about a personal slap. I mean, as you know, because I've joked about it many times, and I think I've done it on the air, you know, I am almost a complete idiot moron when it comes to anything to do with electronics or mechanics. I mean, I'm dumber than dog poop, and I'm the first guy to tell you that. I'm the first guy to stand in line for the dunce cap, right? And I have no problem talking about that, because the beauty of that is I know people who aren't dumbasses, and I'm more than happy to pay them to do the job because I want it done right. So this is a win-win for everybody. If you don't know, educate yourself. Go out there and ask people and take their opinions and thank them for their opinions. Don't argue with them about it. Accept their opinions, because if you ask three or four people who are knowledgeable, who you recognize as being experts in the field or knowledgeable in the field, and they go, yeah, you know, I hate to tell you this, but you're not that great. Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you for being honest. Do you have any ideas of how I can remediate these deficits? Right? And that's good information. I know what I need to do to remediate some of my electronic and mechanical idiocy. I'm just not willing to do it most of the time because I'm, you know, a lazy son of a biscuit eater when it comes to this stuff. And I'm like, you know what, that's too much like the nasty four-letter word work. Screw that. I'll get somebody else to do it and pay them, and I'll thank you and bow down three times to the setting sun and thank you very much, and don't let the door hit you on the bottom way out. And don't forget your money. Right? Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to fool myself. It's ridiculous. You end up suffering in the long run. Any protection you might think you're doing to your ego, you're suffering in the long run. Belly up to the bar from day one, fix the problem, you'll feel so much. Or get somebody to do the work for you, you'll feel a whole lot better.
Or be willing to accept that, you know, this may just not be something you're going to excel at. and you've been given an honest opinion by somebody who ought to know.
And let's face it, folks, everybody in the sound of my voice, I would be willing to bet dollars to donuts that everybody within the sound of my voice on the show has something or several somethings they are really good at. So you can't be great at everything, folks. Find something you're good at, and you know, hopefully it's not deluding yourself with the Dunning-Kruger effect, but find something that's helpful to you that you're good at and maximize it. And if you want to remediate stuff you're not good at because it's important for you, great. But don't feel like you have to be a genius at everything, because nobody's that. I don't give a flip what your IQ points are, how many degrees you got on the wall. It's like, you know, it's like people come into my office and they're like, oh, my God, you're a genius. And, oh, my God, you're – well, yeah, if you're talking about this field, yeah. If you're talking about anything outside of this office, not so much. And as I tell most people, IQ is overrated. If you can't apply it, it's no good. Anybody can sit there and brag about what their IQ is, that they have a high IQ. What are you doing with it? How are you using it, and are you able to apply it efficaciously in a way that doesn't hurt somebody or yourself? That's the real, for me, the real cutting dynamics. Because if you talk to a lot of the antisocials, some of those folks are genius-y IQs. They're just not applying them very well. And they're real good at what they do. It's just not a very socially helpful skill set.
Fair enough. Okay, so that is there are several points in there which I think we'll probably touch on again in section two. But let's go ahead and go to the next question for now. So how does this, and by this I mean Dunning-Kruger and even illusory superiority, how does this differ from your typical megalomania, or what we now know as narcissism? And my general understanding is that Dunning-Kruger is essentially not knowing one's limits, whereas the others are definitely thinking one is the best of everyone at a thing. So can you speak to that?
People who suffer from narcissistic personality disorder are folks that have Dunning-Kruger effect on steroids plus cocaine and crack. So not only do they overestimate, you're right, you're exactly right. No, not only do they overestimate their abilities, they go so far as to think that they are king shit, basically. They think that they're the best thing on the planet, so sliced bread, and nobody can do it better. And if they do something, it's always harder to accomplish than somebody else, and it's always a better accomplishment. And these are also the people, you know, they have the organ, what I call the organ recital. Hey, my head hurts. Hey, my toe hurts. Yeah. Oh, let me tell you, I know you've been through some bad stuff, but let me tell you how bad my shit is. They've always got a one up you. Right. Every coaster bee's like that, but the narcissists are really.
That's their entire jam right there.
That's not a good reason. Yeah. They are the best at deluding themselves.
Okay. So that helps, and I'm glad that what I thought was going to be it does turn out to be it. So that's helpful.
Exactly so.
And then the next thing I want to ask is, does this, and by this I mean, you know, having this bias, come from some kind of thwarted ability to learn our own strengths growing up, being forced too rigidly to conform to someone else's expectations and not allowed the time to experience the process of learning at what we naturally excel? Is that what causes this?
Yeah, what I would say is yes to all of those. Or being told by sometimes well-intentioned parents, oh, you're just the greatest thing. You're the bee's knees. You're the best thing since sliced bread. Oh, my God. You know, and parents, in an attempt to boost self-esteem over rewarding their kids with praise. And I always tell parents, you're not doing your kid a favor if you're setting them up for failure later on, because you're telling them that they tied their shoelaces and they're, you know, Einstein. I'm sorry. That's not helpful. Be honest. I'm not suggesting don't give praise to your kids. I think that's very important to give rewards in the terms of verbal praises when people do things right, but do it in appropriate measure. Don't overgush it any more than you should overpunish it. You know, you've got it. We're back to the balance and boundaries thing that you know we talk about from time to time. it's really important to recognize your kids' accomplishments. And if your kid's struggling with something, I offer to help them and teach it to them. And if you can't do it and it's a skill set that they know, see if you can find somebody who will, even if you have to pay them to do it. Right? You're going to create much more self-efficacious kids by adequately rewarding them in an appropriate measure and by helping to train them to do what they're supposed to do and to expect developmentally appropriate behaviors, not try to over-parentify them too early or infantilize them. You know, give them get-out-of-jail-free cards when they're 10 years old. You know, when you're still going to the bathroom and wiping their tush because they haven't learned how to do that. I'm just making that up. But, you know, what I'm saying, you don't want to over-pathologize your kid. You don't want to, you know, infantilize your kid any more than you want to parentify them.
Yeah.
You know, giving them too much stuff to do that's beyond their developmental ability to do that. You know, there's just all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, it can come from being frustrated and then you develop this narcissistic defense so that you don't want to appear to be foolish or weak or incompetent or stupid or whatever. And the being compared against your brothers or sisters if you have siblings. Why can't you be like your brother? Well, a parent should never say that to a kid, ever.
Yeah.
Or why can't you be like your sister or whatever? Okay, why can't you be like Susie or Johnny? Or because you're not. We're all individuals.
Yeah.
We all have strengths. We all have weaknesses. We're all average on certain things, right? It's just the name of the game. Take your kid where he or she is and encourage them to be better if they want to be and then help them out getting there. Don't infantilize them and don't do the work for them, for God's sake. I know a lot of parents do that. But don't expect appropriate behaviors beyond the developmental level. And if you want them to get there, start showing them in increments how to get there that are appropriate for their cognitive and emotional development.
Yeah. Okay. And what I may do is I may segue into the next set of questions because there are lots of pieces that seem to be in both sections, and you may have answered pieces of these things before. And feel free to stop me if you do want to bring something up. But I'm going to go right on to section two, which is what can be done if you do have Dunning-Kruger traits or are close to someone who does. And then the first question I have is related to what we've just been talking about. Dunning-Kruger, illusory superiority, or even mere arrogance, hubris, or other self-delusional conceits are more traits than treatable clinical pathologies per se. So what exactly causes them and what is to be done about it, if anything at all? And you have partially touched on this already. But if there's anything that you want to refocus on or also bring up,
I would just say that if you think you have this and you're worried about it and you talk to people and they say, no, and you really don't believe them, you think they're shining you on, go see somebody like me and get an honest opinion. I'll tell you one way or the other. I mean, I'll be very blunt with you about it. I'll be nice about it, but I'll be very honest and blunt about it. You know, it's like a lot of people I've had a fair amount of people who are worried about their kids doing a particular behavior because they want to nip stuff in the bud, and I think that's very smart of parents. And they bring the kid in, and I go, you know, honey, count your blessings. Your kid made a dumb mistake. Okay, go home and tell them you love them and you know, bitch smack them if they do it again. your kid's fine, okay? Your kid's just be the kid. You know, there's no cure for adolescence, I'm sorry. this is not aberrant behavior. It's annoying, but it's not aberrant, right? And I've had, you know, people who got caught for DUIs. And I've had a lot of these people come in. And as you know, in the state of Georgia, now if you get caught, even for one DUI, you have to go see a clinical evaluator. And I certainly see people who have a drinking problem or drug problem, but I also see people who just made a dumbass mistake. You know, they had a couple of drinks, they ate some food, they thought they were fine, they had a couple more drinks, and then they drove. And they were swerving, or the light was out, and they got stopped for a taillight being out, and the policeman said, hey, have you been drinking? Yes, officer, I've been drinking. They were honest. Yes, officer, I've been drinking, but I came from dinner, and do you mind blowing, you know, a breathalyzer? No, no problem. They blow the breathalyzer, and they're of the limit. They get arrested. Okay, they made a dumb mistake. They're not an alcoholic. They're not a drug addict. You know, again, show me a person who had a mistake, or show you God. come on, people, really? So when somebody comes in and they don't have this Dunning-Kruger problem, I'm perfectly happy to tell them, well, congratulations, you don't have it. You know, you're really awesome at this stuff, and you're not over-exaggerating it. You know, that doesn't give you the right to brag about it and laud it over other people. That's when you start to touch on the skirts of narcissism, and that's something you never want to do. But, hey, if you're good at it, don't deny it. You just don't have to go around bragging about it and putting everybody down and showing you how great you are. And if you do have it, I'm going to say, yeah, I'm sorry. I think you're just a little self-delusional here. If you want to learn how to get better, this is what you do.
That actually touches on a brief thing that I'm very familiar with because I grew up in the northern south, but the south nevertheless. It is encouraged, especially amongst young ladies, but everyone, this sense of false modesty, which I think kind of goes hand in hand. You know, it's the flip side of that same coin. Don't rush to be exuberant about how much you suck. I can't do that. I can't do anything. It's just this little thing. You know, I just did a thing. That is so encouraged still. It's 2019. For the love of God, please stop. You know, it's okay to be honest and say, you know, that you are good at a thing. I mean, you don't have to. The narcissist would be like, I'm better than everybody, and we don't need to do that. But it's okay to say that you think you're good, especially, you know, if you can.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
so no false, no swing the pendulum the other way. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. Well, it's like when people say, you know, because people find out that I play guitar and that I'm a musician, and they go, "Oh, well, how are you good? Are you a good musician?" I go, "Yeah, I'm okay." You know, and I consider myself a really good musician, but I'm not going to go brag about it. I mean, it's like I tell people, you know, that's up for you to decide. I'm going to play guitar or bass or whatever I'm going to do, and it's up to you to decide whether you like it or not. Because in the long run, it really doesn't matter how good I think I am. It really matters whether you like what I do or not. I mean, there are artists out there who I think are just superior artists. They're technically great. I hate what they do. You couldn't pay me to listen to that crap. But they are accomplished musicians, and to say that they're not is foolhardy. So just because I like something doesn't mean that you're a good musician or artist or whatever, and just because I hate it doesn't mean you suck, right? So there's a standard by which most people gauge other musicians, and I've had enough competent musicians come to me and tell me I'm a very competent musician. So I go, okay, but if somebody asks me that, I'm not going to go, I'm bad, I'm not going to pull the... I'm not going to put Gene Wilder in Stir Crazy. We bad. Oh, God. I love that scene.
Yeah.
He and Richard Pryor in that movie are just, they are amazingly good. But I'm not doing that. But I'm not going to say I suck because I don't suck. I'm good. I'm really good at certain things. Now, other forms of music, I'm not very good at. And I'm the first to tell you that if you want me to play, you know, triple Z jazz, or you want me to do any kind of major jazz stuff, oh, my God, that is not me, honey. Now, if you want me to play slap bass, that's not me. If you want me to play bass a la Jack Bruce style, Geddy Lee style, I'm not saying I'm that good because I'm not even a millionth that good, or Felix Pappalardi style, yeah, I can do that. I can do a reasonable facsimile, no problem. So that's knowing your limits and being... And, you know, and just being honest about them, both yourself and other people. And if you're really good at something, you know, there's something to be said by a slight bit of humility. You know?
Yeah.
Let other people say you're good. Don't say you're good, because now you're tipping your toes into the narcissism pool again. I'm like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so my next question, and again, you know, we've been treading on to some of these in pieces already.
Sure.
Can those who do this habit stop, and would they care to bother to do so, do you think?
Some would, some wouldn't, in all honesty. Some people, if you point it out to them, they are absolutely mortified that they do it. And you can see the oh shit look on their face, and you can see the blood draining from their face, and the embarrassment sitting there. And they're like, they're truly like, oh my God, I had no idea. right? And obviously those people can easily stop. You pointed out to folks who are starting to tip their toes in the narcissism pool, oh no, they're going to need years of therapy. No. And the Dunning-Kruger thing isn't, I don't want to associate it with narcissism because, they're, you know, as you pointed out earlier, they're two very, very separate entities. But you can certainly enhance other people's viewpoint that you're beginning to develop into a narcissist by constantly doing the Dunning-Kruger effect on yourself, and then it just escalates. So if you've got it and somebody points it out to you, even if you don't want to stop, do yourself a favor and get some help. And whether it's with loved ones or talking to yourself or however you want to do it, I don't care. Because at the very least, you're going to keep yourself from developing a narcissistic personality disorder, and you're not going to scare away and or piss off half the people that you associate with, whether it's at work, school, friends, family, whatever.
Got it. Okay. And then the last question I've got for you is, what is the best way to respond for loved ones, friends, or just anyone in frequent contact, such as, you know, neighbors or coworkers, towards people who may have this trait? What's the best way for people to respond to them?
Confront them, but confront them in very caring ways. Remember, the word confront just literally means from the front or with the front. It doesn't mean yell and scream and point fingers and call you, you know, a stupid bastard or whatever. It means confronting it, looking the problem in the eye and saying, hey, you know, I think we got a problem here. If you really care about somebody, you're going to want them to get help. You're going to want them to improve. You're going to want them to be better because you want them to be better because you give a shit about them. So don't take it. Don't let them go on and on and on about it. If you're a parent seeing a kid do this, intervene with them. If you're a lover or brother or husband or boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever, confront them on it. Don't let them damage themselves. They are really doing themselves harm doing this stuff. They're alienating people, and half the time they don't even know it. So if you really care about them enough to risk the friendship to tell them what's going on and, you know, look at them, do it up front, don't beat around the bush, but do it in a caring, concerned, loving way. They still may not like it. They may respond negatively, but in my personal opinion, this is just me as a personal opinion, this is not necessarily a psychological fact, this is just my personal opinion. If you have a brain and a moral, and you give a shit about somebody, and you call them friend, that's what friends do. They risk the friendship in order to do what's right for the other person because they care enough. And that, to me, is the definition of a friend. Because anybody can bullshit you. That takes no integrity. That takes no balls, whether you have them or not. It takes no intestinal fortitude, let's say it that way. That's a much nicer way of saying it. It takes no honesty. Lying takes no effort at all. Being truthful, you're risking yourself, but you're also being an honest and a really good friend or parent or lover or kid to your parents or whatever. You know, do it because you give a shit about them and because you don't want them seeing them screwing themselves the rest of their lives. This is not the kind of thing that usually goes away if somebody doesn't know they're doing it.
Okay. That is very helpful. So hopefully our listeners can incorporate that. Let me check in with you real quick and see if there's anything else on this topic that we haven't really touched on that you want to bring up before we start wrapping.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Fabulous. So in summary, we hope now that our listeners better understand the Dunning-Kruger effect and can use this understanding to navigate things if they feel someone in their social circle has it, or they might be concerned that they themselves have it, though the trait seems to typically preclude such self-awareness in some cases. But, you know, hopefully you guys will take the risk and, you know, look to the resources that you have faith in and ask for feedback and then be prepared to accept the feedback or at least consider it. So at this point, this will conclude our show on the Dunning-Kruger Effect Part 2. And on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation also to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We will see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday. And I didn't change a date on my script. Apologies. Let me tell you when that date will be. It will be July 24th at 11 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com. We also want to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Thursday the 11th, at 8 p.m. EDT, Travel Itch Radio. Historic Fredericksburg, Virginia takes center stage on Travel Itch Radio Thursday, July 11th, when Dan Schlossberg and Anita Stokes Thomas interview Debbie Ayler of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. Called, quote, the most underrated city in Virginia, Fredericksburg has a rich legacy dating back to the Civil and Revolutionary Wars. It also has many museums and historic structures. And may I also add, as a longtime Virginia resident of many decades, Fredericksburg is a lot of fun to go see if you guys have not. I think it is, I don't know if it's the most underrated city, but it's definitely in the top few. So that's tomorrow night. On Sunday the 14th, 8:30 p.m., I am hosting Fear Walking Dead Online Viewing Party, Season 5, Episode 7, which is called Still Standing. And please follow us on Wednesday, the 24th. I put the 26th, and that's not correct. Excuse me. Wednesday, the 24th at 11 p.m., we will have another episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show. And as of this point, it will probably be on the topic of ADHD, and we will explain that further in a couple of weeks. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on. ¶¶